You are now listening to Out of the Blank.
Go. Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank podcast. I'm here with Steve.
G'day, Rob. Thanks for having me on your show. Really appreciate it.
Now, I have one question for you. Your emails, it says Hotmail. Is that because Google and everything like that is going on in Australia?
It's because I'm old, I think. back when I first got on the internet, Hotmail was the only email around. I don't even think it's existed anymore.
It's like when you see somebody come across with like an AOL or something like that. I'm like, oh my goodness, like you still have one of those? Like you slipped into the system. Cause when Comcast bought that or Verizon bought it, then it was like, I had one email for everything. It was my Comcast one, but I am a millennial and I rarely use my email. So it's all kind of through social media. But what I'm loving about Australia right now is Google's not over there really. I guess they're doing something with Google and they're also banning some social media platforms like Facebook. And I'm like, this is history in the making. Finally, people are realizing the toxicity of it all. Like the fact of like, I think it's just amazing, man.
Yeah, you're right, actually. Well, Facebook's the Australian government decided to try and pursue Facebook for some rental for their news and things like that. And Facebook have gone with some algorithm that's it. We're going to get rid of all news. But what it's actually done in the background is it's taken down some of my friends' podcast sites as well, because, I mean, they've got news on there as well, albeit news that's 2,500 years old. So it's really been a nightmare for some guys over here.
I don't like that. Like, their restrictions or whatever it is that they put on you for, like, something they don't like is always in, like, whatever they feel like it doesn't fit. And I'm like, I mean, I understand YouTube because YouTube's like they have, I think it's like 500 million hours or something that gets posted every minute on there. Just, I mean, it's it's a lot of content. So I'm like, when you get your video gets flagged or something, it makes sense because there's probably just one, they don't have enough people to watch every single video. So it's probably one dude, like you see Bruce Almighty where he's typing all the prayers and he's just saying yes to everybody. That's probably some dude at YouTube just like typing really fast. Like, you know, cancel. But then if you like a couple of my videos, I got banned off Facebook for a Freemasons episode. And I was like, Freemasons, like we have those in my town. I'm like, what was the thing that was wrong with it? They were like, it's under review. And I'm like, why? But I was banned for 24 hours. And I was like, for an actual thing where history of Freemasons is a legit historical thing. And it was an actual person that came on here to talk about that and all the history behind it. And they're like, nope, it could be misinformation. I was like, maybe you should listen to it because I talk a lot of trash on there about cults and stuff. So
no, I've actually been listening to a few of your episodes lately. I've become a little bit of a fan of the show, and anybody who bans one of your episodes is a bloody idiot in my mind.
Well, you know what? That really warms my heart. I really appreciate that, Steve. Now, you do a podcast as well. If you want to let people know what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. It's called Spartan History Podcast. And as the name suggests, it's about Spartan history. Started a little over a year ago now. And it's got about 2,000 followers on the go, roughly about 3,000 downloads per episode, I guess. And it's going really, really well. And it delves right into the Spartan history as well, because, you know, obviously everybody's heard of Thermopylae and the 300 and Leonidas, and that's the sexy part that makes the movies, and Gerard Butler running around with, you know, barely any clothes on and slaying hordes of Persians. Everybody knows that story. But as a real fan of Greek history and Spartan history more generally, I thought they're not really telling the whole story. So I wondered why nobody had done it before. And I thought, well, I'm going to go right back to the start. And a year later, I realized why nobody's did it before. It's an absolute lesson in futility. There's the sources are very spurious. There's a lot of conjecture around the things. And the Spartans themselves were very xenophobic. They had a ritual expelling of strangers once a year from the city. So all the real sources we have on Sparta come from outside of there. So we sort of deal with two versions of the city itself. So it's a tough story to tease out, but it's been a lot of fun.
And it's something like, I mean, there's not really a whole lot of evidence when it comes to, like, you know, it's all kind of conjecture of the way you're kind of reading it too, based on, like, there's not a lot of stuff where you can be like, oh, like, it's not as clear as if I went to the store and I'm like, well, here's the Walmart that's here. It's like you're looking through history books and each different text is like a different translation. You got to funnel it through someone else's words being spoken that way and stuff. And there's nothing that you can really fact check when it comes to, like, yeah, you can look at a couple of articles, but it's so back in the past that we are just going off records of what people are, their own interpretations of it. Like, one thing I always found interesting was, like, I think it's called the Sacred Band of Thebes. I don't know if are you familiar with the Sacred Band of Thebes?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Everyone sees, like, oh, they're all muscular men that lift cows and stuff. I'm like, it was 300 men and 150 gay couples that were one of the strongest armies. Like, didn't they take down I guess the concept of 300 was, because 300 was not based on that. I know that.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring the Sacred Band up, because they were, along with the Theban army and Epaminondas, the general at the time, the real downfall of Sparta. They fought the Spartans at the Battle of Leuctra in 371 BCE, and they really turned the tides on the Spartans in that battle. And it was one of those straws that broke the camel's back, per se, whereby after that, you know, Sparta went from the dominant power in Greece and had been for several hundred years on the battlefield, and basically overnight became a second-rate power and never really rose to prominence again. And the number 300 obviously was significant to the ancient Greeks and to the Spartans in particular. And I don't think that was lost on the Thebans when they did that. But yeah, you're right, they were 150 homosexual couples, which wasn't uncommon in ancient Greek armies. And they performed some very different tactics, I guess, to what the standard hoplite warfare was at the time. They actually stacked their ranks 50 people deep. And if you can imagine, it was a real press of warfare, and the traditional ranks of warfare at that time were about 8 ranks. So 50 people, which was 42 more than what the standard was, really provided a preponderant force against the Spartans, and they really didn't have the answer for it. They were utterly crushed at the battle.
So that just shows, like, as society today, how, like, simple-mindedsetted we've become, considering back then nobody even cared about if you were a male or female. It was really about just, like, their concept of it was freaking amazing. When you start to listen, like, why fathers wanted their kids to be beautiful, like, they wanted their sons to be gorgeous people, because that means that more people would, you know, if they joined the army or whatever, that more people would love them. More people would look at them like, oh, this guy's hot. He's a Ryan Reynolds character. That means more people would be on the lines to try and protect him. But their whole idea of having 150 gay couples was the concept of, if you were going to fight with these people, not consider them as brothers, but if you consider them as lovers, you're going to do a hell of a lot more to protect them, make sure that nobody can hurt them. And I'm listening to that, I'm like, I'm getting goosebumps even just talking about that. I'm like, yeah, that is that is such an, like, so many people are hearing this right now and they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, the concept of how we've turned it in now, where it's like gay has to mean, like, feminine or something like that. It's like their ideas were so different from how we think of it now. And it really puts in the grand scheme of things that it wasn't just survival for them. It was an aspect of, like, the bond that you can really develop when you're actually fighting, like we say, fighting in the trenches, but literally when you're shoving a spear through someone's chest and there's people on horses chopping other people's heads off and stuff, like the barbaricness of it all, but how fascinating their, I guess, complexity of military strategy was just, I mean, even in the 300 movie, I think it kind of did it a disservice, because I saw someone put up, like, was this movie based on the Sacred Band of Thebes? And then he's like, why wouldn't they talk about them being gay? Is that just because that nobody wants to watch a movie about that? And some dude just commented, goes, that's the thing you're really pulling out of the movie, not the 50-foot elephants and all this other type of stuff that's going on. It makes the movie outrageous.
Look, you've really touched on a couple of really interesting things there. And look, as a history, you know, fan myself, you can look at a movie like 300 and say, oh my God, they didn't follow the text to the letter, but who gives a stuff, you know? Like, I want to see 50-foot elephants falling off cliffs, you know? I want to see, you know, thousands and millions of Persian arrows, you know, blotting out the sun. I mean, I want to see that sort of stuff. And I think, you know, if you're going to do it fantastically, they did a fantastic job. And what you mentioned about homosexuality is an interesting thing too. A lot of people, especially people in the classics and academia, have a habit of really placing their own views back onto the past. And I think it's important to take a moment to think about exactly how people lived back then. And rather than casting aspersions from our, you know, privileged future where we live now, we need to really put ourselves back in the minds of people who lived in those eras, who you know, didn't want to have a status symbol like the new iPhone or the new iPad or whatever it might be. You know, for them, it really was living a life of honor and being esteemed. And when you didn't really have an afterlife per se, you only had to be remembered by the people that you lived with, you know. And if you want to be remembered as a brave warrior, as a good man, then you know, brave acts on the battlefield were the way that you were remembered at the end of the day. So it was very important back then. And in particular, when you had your lover standing beside you, you know, you didn't want to be shamed in front of them, him or she.
Yeah, it's kind of like you mentioned something important about like people nowadays kind of putting their own opinions on like stuff in the past. Like so many people talk about like that was horrible that we did that in our history. Yeah, but that was also the mindset at the time. It's not rationalizing, you know, what's going on. Thank God we're not doing it now. Like we're not chopping each other's heads off and stuff. But it's a concept of like there are so many perspectives we don't understand that we cannot get through text that we don't even know about something that happened way back then. Like we don't know what it was like on a daily basis for these people to try and eat, you know, we got idea of it, but to really experience what that is to experience, you know, having to hunt and kill for your food, start training all freaking day on the aspect of like, if you even miss one training session or something, that could be your life and death situation of when you're in the battlefield. And there might be something that you might slip up, you might get a little rusty or something. That's why the king even kept fighting and stuff like that. Like the whole leader, the chieftain, everything. He was on the front lines with the people on the aspect of he didn't want to slip up. Next thing you know, you're taking I'm gonna take a couple vacation days. You come back to battle. Next thing you know, you're getting an arrow through the heart or something like that.
Spoken like a true warrior, Rob. You're born in the wrong millennium.
There's a good point. Would you want to live back in that time period? Like if you could pick anything through history, whether if you want to live more futuristic, like we just hit Mars the other day. So there we go. Would you want to live would you want to live 100 years into the future, or would you want to pick any date in the past? And if you could, if it would be the past, what time period would you want to live in? Would you want to live with the Spartans?
Such a good question. And look, it's one that I've fantasized over, you know, many times over the years. And it's a fantasy that ends the moment I get a headache. Or a toothache or something like that, you know, like if I could go back, yeah, it'd be great. As long as the moment I, you know, required some sort of medical attention or some good dentistry, absolutely. I'd rather, you know, jump back into the modern era. You know, we've never had it so good. But, you know, if I could go back and I could experience those, it would have to be during the Spartans, just because there is so many black spots in the historical record. And I really would love to see, you know, where the truth lies. Is it the mirage that, you know, was perpetuated by the Spartans themselves, but also the mystique that they were held by the rest of the Greeks as well. Like, what was the true story there? And I guess a close second place would be, you know, very late Republican Rome, like during the Caesar and the Pompeys and the Marcus Crassus, that sort of era around there. But, look, I wouldn't trade, you know, the creature comforts for that sort of lifestyle long term.
Yeah, I had my art history teacher ask a very fascinating question. He said, if you could choose to live with the Greeks, or you could choose the Roman lifestyle back at that time period, which one avenue would you go? And we had a list of pro and cons of like, what's good about the Greeks? And I'm like, well, our kind of literature, everything we have when it comes to entertainment, arts, comedy, tragedy, all these types of things that we have with plays and stuff all kind of come from the Greeks and stuff. But he's like, yeah, but after like a 50 list of Greek stuff, he goes, yeah, but the Romans, they were the first ones to really discover like plumbing and actually using like regular bathrooms. And I'm like, well, that's me. I'm going there. Even though there's all these pros on the Greek side, that is a very big one, because like even if it's just like you have a trench in the dirt that leads from your house to a giant open thing where it's like, you know, all of it funnels into there, that's still better than not having one, you know what I mean? Like wiping your, you know, with a holly bush isn't the best scenario. But I am a Greek mythology fanatic. I mean, I love it. I love the lore behind it. I love this because when I was in school, there was nothing I could read. There was nothing. I was just so entertained, and everybody's like, let's read Harry Potter. I'm like, nah, I've seen the movies. I'm good. But then I stumbled across these comic book like books that were by Graphic Universe, and they had lores and myths of like the Mayans, and then they had Hercules, and then they had Persephone and Hades, and they had all these types of mythology type, you know, scenarios. And I started getting super interested into it. And I'm like, oh my God, like it might not be accurate 100%, but it opens up that doorway, just like your podcast can do. It opens up a doorway for people to be like, I never knew that about the Spartans. And then they want to go do the research themselves. They want to tune into another episode. And it's literally keeping history alive, which a lot of people don't understand, is like, doing the podcast recordings, doing anything like this, you're literally making a record. Not like back in the day where they used to paint something on a cave, but they're making a record where it's going to have more legitimacy in the future. But here's where the problem comes in. So the idea is now, and I heard this from, her name is Dr. Valerie. She was on my podcast. She's a Greek mythology. She has her PhD doctorate in it. And she was telling me that now the concept is that they think Plato wasn't even a real person, that it was actually a pseudonym, like how we use. And it makes sense for how we use today. How many people on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, any of that go by their actual name? A lot of the times it's a username or it's a pseudonym. And it's like, oh, my God, that's going to create such distortion in the future when they come to check out our record, like this podcast. You know what I mean? Like if you weren't going to Steve and you were going by like whatever, then it would be like the record of Steve, that this podcast wouldn't be included in it because you would be under a different name in this podcast. So it's like, then it wouldn't, this conversation would never happen, which means if somebody did a paper on our lives in the future, it wouldn't have even existed. I know that's a lot right now, but I'm just saying that's, it has me like all over the place. Cause I'm like, man, if Plato isn't real, that makes a lot of sense that it would be a pseudonym, because a lot of the times back in the day, instead of like now, you don't really have reparations or repercussions, I guess you would say, for your actions. You could just do something and then, oh, someone posted a bad tweet about me under a fake name. But back then, when you spoke something, if they didn't like what you said, there was a giant issue that was going to be involved in it, whether you would get your hand chopped off, whether they would kill you, whether they would, all these lists of things. So that makes sense that they would put a safer bet. You know, a dude's talking about an underwater city. You're kind of like, okay.
Yeah. You got to love these modern historical thinkers. Just when you think you've got it nailed, you have your, the carpet, and they pull that from underneath your feet. I've never heard that theory before, but you know, what she says there makes a lot of sense. At the end of the day, Plato was, you know, he's famous for his dialogues, and most of his dialogues involved a gentleman by the name of Socrates, who was famously committed suicide by punishment by the Athenian government, because apparently he was corrupting the youth. And, you know, Plato had nothing but disdain for the Athenians and for the democracy that they so espoused, and rightfully so. As a Spartan lover, I don't have a great deal of time for the Athenians either. And anybody who's listening to the podcast, no, I don't miss out any opportunities and having a good dig at them, but I've never considered before. But you're right. I mean, you know, people might look back in the future and say, now who's Lord of the Ducks 22? Like, you know, that guy must have been a real thinker. But yeah, of course, you know, it's just a pseudonym, like you say. So that's a really interesting thought. I've never thought of it like that, but it's got me thinking, yeah.
Do you think that we pull any, like, at least from your studies of Spartan history and stuff like that, do you think we pull anything today that we still use based on them? Because I know everyone talks about we pull stuff from the Greeks and stuff, but it's weird. Since the Marvel movies came out, a lot of people started getting really interested in Norse mythology, and they actually found that we correlate more with Norse mythology than we do with Greek mythology or Greek history, which is insane, because all my years of schooling is basically out the window, because I thought we were like, we came from the Greeks. And then now it's like, well, actually, we have more in common with the Norse. And it's like, well, why didn't they mention that? It's like, well, did you want to hear about a person raping and pillaging a whole entire village and stuff like that? we prefer to keep it light with the Greek stuff, you know, plays and all that. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Look, I think, yeah, there's definitely, I mean, on the side of the Greeks, for sure. I mean, our language is a derivative of the Greek language. And there's still, now, what was the number? I think there was about 50,000. I mean, English is a very broad language. It's over, I think, 1.4 million words. I think about 50,000 of those have a direct correlation with the ancient Greek language, and obviously, you know, architecture and poetry and plays and that sort of ilk. But yeah, I think you know, genetically speaking, and probably from its more recent nature, the Norse mythology definitely has a lot more tie-ins towards, you know, our, I guess, Anglo-centric culture in the West, I suppose. But oh no, most definitely the Greeks, for sure, are a massive influence on Western civilization. In fact, you know, if the Spartans hadn't have been there at Thermopylae and tragically lost the battle, but it was one of those, one of those defeats that ended up being a victory, the world today could look severely different. The Persians were the most powerful empire the world had seen up until that point in the Western world. And if the Spartans weren't there to at least slow them down and bolster the backbone of the Greeks, then who knows where they would have stopped. The nascent Roman Empire was in its infancy in 480 BC. It had only just become a republic, I think, 31 years before. So there would have been no stopping the Persians. And Darius and Xerxes, the Persian emperors in question, were very land hungry and interested in extending their empire above and beyond their ancestor Cyrus the Great, who was the great Persian conqueror, I suppose. But in answer to your first question with the Spartans, their story's undergone a little bit of a demonization, in particular after World War II, where the Nazis, for better or for worse, took a lot of what the Spartans did on the sides, I suppose, and they made it part of their culture. The Spartans had a reputation for eugenics and a very authoritarian state, and the Nazi regime underneath Hitler really tried to tie themselves into that. And I've even read somewhere that the German people descended somehow from the Spartans, or at the very least the Greeks. So after World War II, they really were a bit of a topic, persona non grata, so to speak, the Spartan people. But definitely since the 70s and 80s, they've undergone a little bit of a rehabilitation, and now they're front and centre in most academic studies of ancient Greeks, along with the Athenians there. So, yeah, hard to say Norse or Greek, but I'd be willing to give them both an equal share in influence today.
I think what's so powerful about, Sparta is probably the aspect of, I know Athens gets talked about probably a lot throughout history. And I remember in my history class, I was sitting there, we were learning about, Athens and Sparta. And I was like, just pro Sparta, because it was around the time the 300 movie came out. So I was like, come on, you're barbarians, you're crazy. But then if you start looking at Athens, for instance, their technology was way more advanced. There was a way bigger civilization over there. The Spartans were just so powerful. It was a small group, but they were so intense, so strong, that even if they were going against up an army against of 1,000, they were still managing, where it was like, holy crap. Like, it literally took all of kind of Athens' power to be able to kind of push that down and snuff out that flame. Even though when you say they lost, when you really look at the grand battle of things, I wouldn't technically count that as a loss, because that was damn close. But it was a sign of doesn't matter how many you have. They were I always use this reference of when in the war with Germany, they would have one really, really good tank, but by the time they would create one, we would have six. We were like McDonald's just pumping out tanks. So they got overran. That's like with Sparta. They were overran with the amount of enemies that they had, but they were way more trained and way harder, in my opinion. I mean, a lot of people look at that and go, that's horrible that they used to have these rites of passage where you would have to be left out into the wilderness and fend for yourself and then come back to camp. I'm like, yeah, but it made them tough. It made them strong, because what they were thinking of was military strategy. That's where all their mindset was in fighting, was in trying to be the best, was to make sure that nobody could come onto their territory and hurt their family. In that mindset, it makes sense. But for people now, it's like, but why wouldn't you focus on science and research? It was like, because at that point, they were like, we could capture another place and get the science and research. Like, their whole idea was, this is my family. This is everything in my tribe, is my group, and I will do whatever I can to protect them. And that means a lot. That means putting my life on the line to be able to do so. And I respect that highly.
100%. Yeah. It's an interesting one in that, when you say it was a loss but a victory, you're 100% right. And look, let's face it, a year later, they came back and they kicked the Persians' ass at Plataea in 479 BCE. And look, one of the big reasons for the Spartan military dominance at that time was the nature of their culture. They'd actually, there was a period in Greece from about the 8th century through to the 7th where land was at a premium. And look, most battles in ancient Greece were fought on land. There's only about 30% of the territory that's suitable for farming. The rest is very mountainous. So in that period, most of the Greek cities decided to send out colonies, and they colonized the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. And there was around about 1,000 different Greek polis, or cities scattered around those areas there. Whereas the Spartans, they decided to defy the geography. They were nestled within a little valley called the Eurotas by the river of the same name. And they had two large mountain chains on either side of the city of Sparta, one the Taygetus and the other one the Parmon. And to the west across the Taygetus Range was another group of people called the Mycenaeans. And the Spartans in the mid-8th through to the mid-7th, rather than go over, they went around the Taygetus Mountains and they captured and enslaved the entire population of the Mycenaeans. And it was a very interesting case, whereas slavery wasn't uncommon in Greece, but enslaving other Greeks was very, very uncommon. And it was looked down upon by the rest of the Greeks, but they couldn't really do much against the Spartans anyway. What were they going to do? Go out there and try and fight them for it. But because they had an enslaved population within the borders of their cities, they had to become a militarized state. And what that did was led down to the time of the Persian Wars, where they had a trained force that had been, in fact, at arms for a period of a couple of hundred years. So they really provided the backbone of the Greek forces and the true fighting muscle that was at the center of the battlefield that gave the Greeks the opportunity to push back the Persians there during the Greco-Persian Wars. And those wars really signified a turning point in Greek culture. Before that, we classify the Archaic period as occurring before the Greco-Persian Wars, and the Classical period, where obviously Socrates and Aristophanes, the playwrights, Euripides, and all that sort of, they all came after that. It was like the victory against the Persians made the Greeks bold. From there, the art changed from these sculptures without form, and so the form within the stone burst out, and you get these lovely, beautiful friezes and sculptures up there, all the beautiful plays that we're still lucky enough to be able to read now. And really, everything that we consider Greek culture came after those battles there. So the Spartans certainly were the driving force for the victory, and they gave the Greeks the opportunity to expand their culture and become what we remember now in the history books.
You're telling me that since they won, that the statues that they were creating actually had more character to them? Like,
absolutely. Yeah. We define it as Archaic and Classical period. And I mean, they're modern terms that we cast back, but the demarcation, the line of demarcation, you can trace directly to the Greco-Persian Wars. It was almost like overnight, the Greeks were like, it's like a celebration of their culture. Like, my God, we beat the Persians. Before that, for better or for worse, most of Greek culture aped Egyptian culture. And you can see that in the early works. There's a lot of sphinxes and that sort of representation, and a lot of Eastern, like Assyrian and Persian sort of works of art, very heavily influenced. After that, the Greeks said, stuff is, we can stand on our own two feet and we're going to lead culture from here. And from there on in, they were the real driving force of culture and literature in the Mediterranean from there on in, until the Romans came along and basically made it part of their own culture.
That's fascinating, man. Imagine if they wouldn't have had that win. Imagine if they would have lost. Imagine where would the statues be today? I mean, you see those Greek statues of like Poseidon, or you see, of the stone soldiers and stuff. I mean, besides them all being insanely ripped, where I'm like, that does not make sense how you would get those obliques from throwing a spear. It doesn't make sense to me, but there's so much character in it. Like, there's a sense of like actual creativity and art form. And I mean, yeah, we have that kind of today with, like, if you want to talk about like Adobe Paint Shop or Photoshop apps and stuff like that. But the idea back then of like true passion, where you'd just be walking through your town and then some dude just chiseling out a giant statue in the middle of the town, you're like, what are you doing, man? Like, yeah. it's 6 p.m. bro, and it's like, yeah, the dude's, yeah, just chiseling away. Like, I have an idea in my head and I'm going to create it. And to see that expand, I mean, there's a game out there that came out where I was way fascinated with Greek mythology way before this game came out, but it was a couple of years ago, and it sparked a lot of people's interest into it. Same with the Viking culture right now. Another version of this game came out, Assassin's Creed.
Assassin's Creed, of course, yes.
So that, I like that game on the concept of, I think it sparks interest into the society today more than a history book can. So people can see that, play that game, and then they can actually go and research this stuff. Same reason why I love Leonardo da Vinci was the second game took place in Florence, Italy, and you got to work with Leonardo da Vinci. Now and then Odyssey, you got to work with Socrates and Aristotle, and then transferring over to the Viking era now, you get to learn about the Vikings, the pillaging, and you start to learn about how they took fly algaric mushrooms when they pillaged and stuff like that. And it's like, that's what I love about this, is that I don't think history is being lost. I think it's being translated into a new form, and hopefully people take the right avenue with it instead of being like, oh, that was a cool game to play. They actually do their research and be like, where is this actually from? I want to hear some of this folklore. I want to hear some of the myths and the tales, not just watch a Marvel movie and feel like you know how to speak all about Loki and the whole Norse mythology. Like, it's crazy concept, because history, I think, is always going to be needed. History is always going to be wanted. And that's what really attracted me to your podcast page. I was like, because a lot of people don't know a lot about the Spartans. I'm still new to it. I mean, but everyone sees the 300 movies and they're like, oh, it was barbaric. It was fighting. It was these men and like, you know, but there's so much more than that movie shows than the action and all the fighting. Yeah, that's cool. But the emotional connection, the emotional like loss and just grievance of people that are watching their family members go off into war. You know, a father and a son, a woman that's staying at home and is crying because she's afraid if, you know, she has to take care of the whole thing while all the men went out to go fight into the war and not knowing if they're going to return. And if they do return, is her lover going to be part of that? You know what I mean? It's this, that when you start to understand that perspective of things, it really puts more gravity into the story or the history that you're reading, which I think is of prime importance.
Yeah, that's really well said. I think, what you mentioned there about the women in particular, you know, waiting for their men to return home, you know, and you'd see that army on the horizon returning from the battlefield. And, you know, obviously the faces would be indistinct from a distance and you'd be, you know, straining your eyes trying to pick out, you know, was your loved one there? Was your brother there? Was your father there? Was your husband there? Was your son there? It would have been an incredibly traumatic time to live. And look, Spartan women were really set apart, not just in the sources, but most definitely within Sparta, within the Athenian sources, within Sparta as well, because they were, there's a bit of an anecdote that's attributed to a woman named Gorgo. She was actually the wife of Leonidas, and I believe she was being questioned. This is all apocryphal, and she was being questioned by an Athenian woman. She says to Gorgo, why do you Spartan women have so much control over your men? And she replied by saying, it's because only Spartan women give birth to real men. And it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bit of a jibe at the end of the day to sort of say that Athenian men weren't real men, but it held true. Spartan women were not only visible within Greek society, they also had a voice. And Plutarch, who's one of a famous biographer from the second century AD, he was a Greek Roman. He recorded a number of sayings from ancient Spartan men, but almost individually in the history texts, he also has sayings of Spartan women. And the recordings give you a real sense of how brave and how truly independent women these were. I mean, for an Athenian, to put it against what the Athenians were like, an Athenian male would have been scandalized if any other male unrelated to his own wife would have spoken about her. And she would have been expected to stay within the deepest of recesses within her house and really have had no profile whatsoever outside the house. There was no education, like formal education, apart from, you know, how to raise a household, how to be a mother. Whereas Spartan women were educated, highly educated, and they were also put through athletic training, like wrestling and running. There's a famous play called the Lysistrata by Aristophanes, and it takes place during the Peloponnesian War, as I like to call it, the Athenian War, because I take the Spartan side, but it's traditionally called the Peloponnesian War. And in the Lysistrata, the women of Athens have gone on a sex strike because they're tired of their men fighting and they want them to finish fighting. So the way they decide to bring an end to the war is to go on a sex strike there. And there's a character in the play who's from Sparta, and the Athenian woman starts saying, you know, some really derogatory things to the Spartan, trying to egg her on. But the Spartan woman's just so proud. She's saying, oh my God, you know, what a fine pair of breasts you have. She says, of course I've got a fine pair of breasts. You know, I do heel to buffet jumps and I run around and things like that. And, you know, there would have been some laughter in the Athenian theatres, but they could hardly miss that Spartan women were indeed different to their own women. They had property rights. They could inherit property. And there was actually a Spartan woman by the name of Kyniska, which means little puppy, who won the chariot race at the Olympic Games in the early 4th century. Now, of course, she wasn't controlling the chariot, but she raised the horses. So she was, you know, effectively the team owner, I suppose. And it was, you know, it was a very, very individual thing to Greek history, that Spartan women were very visible among society.
it's a different mentality if you look at that. Like, if you look at like the Spartan women, the whole idea is like the Spartans knew, like, you're going to create life that is going to be our next army. That is one of the most important things ever. And the other cultures looked at it like, you need to stay in the house. Men got to go out and do the job. It's like the Spartans looked at it as a level of respect of like, we need to protect you. You're not in the eyes of, you're not my wife. You're a goddess. You're something that is going to keep our civilization growing and creating this unstoppable race of warriors. And this, that's a different mentality, which you get to see, which I think is of prime importance to highlight, because I think everybody thinks back then they're all just like, women stay in the house, men go out and work. And it's like, in some cultures, sure. But there are some cultures that looked at them like they were the Amazons. I don't know how to pluralize that word, but
that like was Amazonians,
yeah. Amazonians, like Wonder Woman, that whole idea was a giant race of women. And then they didn't let men into the group because they were keeping themselves strong. They were keeping themselves elite. They were keeping themselves perfect. It's the concept of there were places where there was a correlation. There was a partnership, I would say, more than it was with a relationship. It was a, you are literally higher than I am on the pedestal because you create life that is going to create this wonderful Spartan race to keep on going.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the Amazonians are a funny one. They, you know, the ancient Greeks were traditionally, not traditionally, they were excessively misogynistic in their practices, especially the Athenians. And it's sort of, you know, they created this race of warrior women who were independent. They had the good grace to at least live somewhere to the north of the Black Sea, you know, away from men entirely, and only came to town for the purposes of breeding. But see, the Spartan women had a very interesting inheritance in that they were the direct descendants in their own mind and through mythology of Helen of Sparta, or Helen of Troy, as she's more popularly known. But she was, of course, living in Sparta when Paris decided to come over and either, you know, abduct her or take her willingly. There's a few different schools of thought there. But the classical and the archaic Spartans from the 8th century onwards, they were very much aware of their inheritance from Helen. They built a large temple to her not far from Sparta, a place called Pratne, about 4 kilometres to the east, and they performed ceremonies and dances in her honour, and many of their songs referenced Helen. So they were quite aware of their place in society, I suppose, and even the earliest source that we have, Homer, refers to Sparta as the land of the beautiful women, referring to Helen, even though he was writing some 500 years after the legendary Battle of Troy took place, I suppose. So, yeah, no, you're right, 100%.
If I could take you back to the Spartan era, and I could choose, you get to start your own little civilization, what would you consider more of a prime importance? Would you consider the research? Would you consider military of prime importance like the Spartans? Or would you be more on like the Athens route where it's like, we're going to focus on science, we're going to focus on exploration, culture, all these other types of things?
Yeah, definitely the latter. Look, I mean, I love the wars, but you really see the Greek people just devour themselves in particular. Like, you know, this beautiful moment happened where they came together in what was truly pan-Hellenic or all Greek for the cities that decided to fight. Many Greek cities decided to join the Persians for varying reasons. And after those great victories, they just devoured themselves. Athens and Sparta, you know, went at it for 100 years. And by the time of Philip of Macedon and Alexander the Great after that, there was really nothing left of what we could consider of Greece. And the Macedonians wiped them out. And from there on, we take it into the Hellenistic period, where it was more Macedonian-centric rather than Athenian-Spartan-centric from there. So for me, I would have personally really liked to understand a lot more about, I mean, we have records of about, I think, 4 classical playwrights that have come down to us now. There was thousands of plays that we've missed out on, you know, many hundreds of thousands of letters of text that we've missed out on as well. The burning of, you know, the Library of Alexandria was a great massive tragedy to the, I guess, the repository of literature that they had at the time there. I would have, there's not a historian or anybody that's interested in history I know that would crave to have a few of those books back that we're missing out on. And you hear them referenced quite often in other people's texts, and it's just so tantalizing. So yeah, definitely I would have loved to have seen some of it more, you know, literature and cultural references and influences that we've lost now.
Yeah, and you look back then, the actual term philosopher, it means something a little bit differently today, considering that if you check everyone's bio on Instagram or something, it says philosopher in there. And I'm like, okay, hang on a second. A philosopher, we're not talking about Plato style or Aristotle. We're talking about something different here. But if you, I would love to go back then, and I would love to just look around and kind of see who is thinking above all others. Who is thinking on the mindset of, like, you look at someone and you're like an Elon Musk of the back then or something, you're looking at them like, huh, like you're thinking, but like your creation, your ideas that you're writing down, you know, like if you're watching Leonardo da Vinci walking around to everyone else is kind of infatuated with their own lives. Like, it's kind of a good representation of today, for instance. We're so drawn up into our own minds, but we're not expressing it creativity wise. We're worrying. We're thinking about surviving like they did back in the day, but in a different form of, oh my God, how am I going to get this Instagram post to 10 likes or something like that? It shows you when you drop those necessities or those balls and chains that are hooked to you through social media, you know, things of this sort. When you drop those and let those go, you can truly express your creativity, much like if you were Leonardo da Vinci thinking of ideas. The issue was he was in his head, but he was in his head with ideas, looking around and trying to find ways to improve things rather than trying to find ways to occupy his time, which nowadays we're just creating things to occupy our time. Or, you know, we're building up homes and houses and stuff like that that's isolating us from the outside. And I don't want to say it, but it's true, is that hard times create like hard people. They create tougher, stronger people. The Spartans knew that. They knew that puts you through some extremes. Even if you're 6 years old, doesn't matter. You're going out and you're going to go kill and hunt a wolf, whatever the hell it is. They knew that that was of prime importance. So if you've ever experienced pain, if you've ever experienced something hard or difficult, when you get past that, you realize it made you tougher. Like, I have many moments in my life, probably sure you do too, where there were moments where you were like, that was a horrible time. But would you trade any of that in for not having that at all? Because that experience turns you into the person you are today. I mean, the person that is hardened, not to the point where they wouldn't let anybody in if they wanted to, but on the aspect of it made you tougher, it made you stronger, be able to make you hold more when it came to the aspect of knowing that what that pain is like. And when something gets close to that again, you're not going to let it stop you. You're going to keep on pushing forward.
Yeah, it's character building, right? I mean, you know, adversity is the mother of invention, and reinventing yourself. And, you know, the line, the hard times make the hard men. But then, you know, we're in the time where the hard men made the easy times, and the easy times make the soft men. And you find that there's a real lack of civic pride these days. And like you say, it's all about, you know, what post can I get up that's going to go viral on Twitter? You know, it's more about, you know, what can the government do for you? Everybody's talking about, you know, privileges and rights. You know, there's no talk about responsibility anymore, which is, you know, the most important thing, you know, to pick up the heaviest load you can and try to, you know, try to carry it, try to build yourself up from there. And, you know, look, we've seen obviously in Australia, you know, it's America's a massive influence in our culture over here. And we've watched, you know, some of the really interesting events that occurred last year in your country. And, you know, it's really scary where you see the mindset is, you know, you've got people in the street who are, you know, running around under the veil of some crazy ideology and, you know, not really doing their duty as citizens. Whereas for the Greeks, and I hate to keep dragging it back there, but you invited me onto your show, you know, for them, the city was the most important thing. There's a Greek word, stasis. It's basically stasis. You know, we take it to mean nothing happening, a state of inertia, I guess. A state of inertness. Whereas for the Greeks, stasis meant civil war for them, because for the Greeks, it wasn't about them. The most important thing to an ancient Greek was the city, the polis. And you can extend that for us in this day and age, whereas the polis, people, they didn't use the word Greeks. You were a Spartan, you're an Athenian, you're a Theban, you're a Macedonian. You weren't a pan-Hellenic. There was no Greek empire per se. But the city to them was like our countries in this day and age. And if the city was in a state of civil war, it was in a state of stasis. There was no progression. You know, the arts had to stop. You know, the architecture had to stop. The literature had to stop. And you had to go out there and basically kill your fellow man to reestablish order. And that was the greatest tragedy. And, you know, I see a lot of stasis, for lack of a better word, you know, creeping into our society, where rather than trying to better ourselves and trying to, you know, improve our lot of life, and let's face it, we've never had it better. If you go back through history, and I've read a lot of history, we've never had it better in this day and age. You know, we should be so thankful, but there's just this ingratitude that's out there at the moment, and it's really scary to see. And it's not just in America, it's infecting the West in general at the moment. And you know, I don't really know where it goes, but fingers crossed for you guys, because you're the shining light of the world, and if you guys can't figure out, you're all stuffed.
It's I think it's an aspect of what happens when you lose a lack of communication. The world right now, especially over here in the States, is an aspect of like, you're not talking to your fellow man anymore. You know, the issue is that when we're destroying our own progress by trying to think that we're thinking progressively, we're trying to do actions that feel like they are being progressive, but they're not. They're actually keeping us in this state of null, where we're just not expanding out. We're actually just tearing up everything else. We're not building anything. We're just tearing things down on an aspect of like, they have a good idea with it. Same thing with like the Spartans trying to create a super race. It's a good ideology. I can see their thinking. But it's not working in the grand scheme of things, because all we're doing is tearing each other apart. And I believe that's what happens when you come to a place where there's no community anymore. There's more people than we've ever had, but there's no community. There's no communication. It's the same thing in China. Back in the old dynasties in China, people didn't really need to communicate with each other. It was simple how you do's, and then you kind of go with your family, and then you learn that way. So they're okay with building up so much now, where in China, they can just walk right through you. Like, there's no like bump into you, I'm sorry. It's, we're going to walk right through you, because there's so many people there. They just see that as like, there's not even you don't even need to address it. We understand you're trying to get to where you're going. Yeah. That's a lack of communication, but that's been throughout their history. America has always had like, hey, talking to your neighbors, all these other types of things. And then now we're at a point where we choose to funnel that into a device. And that's when I saw ban Facebook and all these things, I was like, this is history in the making. It's an aspect of like, hopefully we adopt that. Hopefully we see all the violence and all the nonsense, anger that gets us all frustrated at each other and put up against sides. Because when you're battling people in your own civilization, in your own town, in your own city, you're really doing yourself a disservice, because you're never going to see growth. And we can see that throughout anything in history. Every old civilization knew we have to work together despite our differences on the aspect to overcome this problem. But nobody's looking at that anymore. We're just looking at like, oh, did you see Ted Cruz or Cruz, whatever, went to Cancun, and when we're supposed to be on lockdown, I'm like, who gives a shit? They're politicians. You know, they're bad, but you're pointing it out like it's not like it's a brand new thing. You know they're sketchy. Let's focus on the issue at hand, which is, how are we going to make it to the next day? Don't think about how are you going to make it to the next day. How are we going to make it to the next day? That small little difference in a phrase is the biggest aspect of things. And same thing with like Socrates back in the day. He knew his words can convince people, can get people riled up, can get the morale up. Same thing with, you know, the army of thieves you were talking about in the beginning. They knew like, hey, if you had a relationship, a male relationship with your farmer friend, it was going to increase morale. It was going to increase production. It was going to increase these things. That doesn't mean go over and kiss your neighbor on the lips. That means an aspect of like having that sense of connection, having anything, whether it's love, whether it's friendship, whether it's even just a how do you do, when you actually sit down, just like a podcast, have a conversation like this, you get to know someone, you get to talk with someone. It's a sense of relief. It's a sense of connection that I feel like is definitely needed right now, with considering how much we're kind of more about shutting ourselves away rather than opening ourselves up.
Screaming at each other, where's your mask, you know? And I think you're the sort of man that could have philosopher next to his title on Twitter and earn that right at the end of the day.
That's too much pressure on me.
Well, I actually don't know. You might already have it there, but you certainly earned it. So what got you into podcasting yourself? Like, was it to get that message out? Was it to sort of bring people together and start having this sort of discussion? Like, how did it come about?
It started. I had a kid I talked to in high school. He's actually been on this podcast when I used to do the first 90 in person. And we hadn't talked like 5 years out of school, but I'm always that type of guy where if I actually ask you how your day's going, I legit want to know how your day's going. So we sat, what, 30 minutes a day for a year at lunch or something. I gave him my phone number. Then he calls me like 5 years out of high school on top of his roof drunk. And he was like, I'm going to jump. And I just talked to him for a good couple of hours. And then, you know, we sort of, you know, I talked him off the ledge, and next thing you know, he's getting his life on track and everything like that. It came over, we talked about it in a podcast and everything, but I started to notice we're all suffering. Like, as much as people don't, I mean, I have my good days and my bad days too, but I started to notice like you, when you open up the era or the door for communication, no matter if you have different siding views and you don't let it turn into a debate, the worst thing I think an educator or the worst thing I think someone can do is when they start talking down to someone, is because you're showing, or your idea is that you're better than who that person is. And I believe in all aspects, whether, yeah, you know more than me about Spartan history, but I could tell you about a bug collection you might not know. Like, there's always information. It's like a trade. It is literally, you're going to benefit from this. I'm going to benefit from this. It's this idea that we're going to communicate and we're going to enhance each other's perspectives with our own perspectives that we can't develop because we have to see it through the eyes of somebody else. You know, talking through with so many people, you start to realize like, I'm getting paid in perspective. I'm getting an enhanced view on everything, where you start to see all the little crummy bullshit that you choose to hold you down every single day that really doesn't mean anything. Yeah, you got bills to pay. But at the same time, there's like, I've always said this, there's 65,365 days in an average lifespan of 71 years. So why would you waste a moment or one day of that being unhappy? And yeah, it's a lot to say that. But in the grand aspect of things, when you start doing things that include positivity into your life, and that doesn't mean like go hug trees or anything, it just means doing something you've neglected. If you want to research a certain topic, I know so much about 19th century Victorian surgery because my buddy was interested into it, then I got interested into it. It's fascinating stuff, but it's something that can only enhance your growth, not stunt it, like everything we're doing now where people are just communicating and having battles on Twitter. There's no growth there. Nobody's learning. You're just you're losing a connection with someone based on a text or based on a faulty way of talking to each other.
Yeah, look, that's it's traditionally, trees are very selfish as well. I've never had one hunt me back, so I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. But you know, absolutely, I think if you're not prepared to go into a discussion and, you know, fully accepting that the person that you're talking to might know something you don't know and therefore can enrich your life. And you know, getting into the habit of genuinely listening to people, as you started with there, and you know, not just waiting for your turn to speak, that's when you really start to grow. You know, like, I mean, we can all wrap ourselves up in a little echo chamber and just assume at the end of the day that, you know, we've got it all sorted out, that the world's against us and, you know, we're the only people that are right. But you know, you've got to look at the common denominator in a situation. And the common denominator in those situations is generally a person who's very close-minded and very selfish. You know, like, you need a, you know, diversity is thrown around like a, you know, it's just a, it's a candy word these days, but true diversity is diversity of thought. And it's great that you're bringing those sorts of people together to have a chat with you and, you know, getting out, you know, what makes them tick and what makes yourself tick and seeing where those things meet in the middle, seeing where those things disagree and how you can develop and grow from there. I think it's a really marvelous thing that you're doing. It's been an absolute pleasure just to have a conversation for a change rather than having to labor over a script and record and produce something like that. It's a fantastic format you've got here. It's been a lot of fun.
I appreciate it, Steve. And I do want to ask you before we wrap up is, what's one thing in your mind that through all your research and everything you've done with the podcast, you found to be the most fascinating thing about Spartan history or just anything that you've covered?
Yeah. And it actually happened the other day. It's more broadly about the Greeks in general. And I think we touched on it once or twice throughout this podcast about how, you know, we often think, oh, the Greeks gave us this, the Greeks gave us that. And it was just a little interesting little tidbit that came up the other day when I was learning about the history of the Rosetta Stone, which, as you probably know, is what we use to decipher the Egyptian hieroglyphs. And if it wasn't for the Greek that was written on the Rosetta Stone, we would never have been able to decipher Egyptian hieroglyphs and would have lost all that rich history that the Egyptians so beautifully carved on just about every blank piece of stone that they had. And I thought to myself, those bastards, they're just so prescient. They even knew that we'd need them to decipher the hieroglyphs in the future. So they carved it on there, knowing, you know, 2,500 years later that we'd find it, be able to decipher these hieroglyphs from there. I thought, my God, those guys, you know, you just never know where the end is with the Greeks. It's an absolute well of beauty and depth. It's a beautiful place to go, and I really do enjoy what I do with the podcast.
That's awesome. It's funny because, like, if you look at, like, ancient hieroglyphs, seeing things on rocks, and if something didn't age well, say a piece broke off, you're missing a giant script of text. Now it's like, well, if you don't click the record button on a Zoom app, then future generations aren't going to see it. Like, it's a weird shift and change. It's pretty interesting to see. I'm wondering what the future is going to hold for sure. I mean, they're going to have a backlog of information. I know that.
I bet you they wish they had some autocorrect back in those days with the chiselists for sure. We're very lucky, eh?
Dude, I'm telling you, when the guy that was creating, what is it, Stonehenge, it's supposed to be a clock. And I was like, there's that one guy that came up and was like, man, what is this? He goes, well, it's a way to decipher the sun in the sky and be able to tell us what time it is. It's fascinating invention I just discovered. And the guy goes, awesome. He goes, what about us, you know, daylight savings time, you know, when we go back an hour, how do you do that? And the guy just looks at him like, no, we're not doing that here. Not here.
Well, before you go, I'll tell you a funny one. Where I live in Queensland here, we don't have daylight savings, and it's been put to referendum, I think, 6 or 7 times over the years. And that's a good excuse, you know, the Stonehenge, you can't rotate it. But the things that we come up with in Queensland, in Australia here, to avoid daylight saving, even though I've lived in other states where we've got it, and it's a brilliant thing, they think that the funniest excuse I've ever heard was, well, if we change the time, the cows won't know what time it is to eat. And I think, don't remember the cows going off the Gregorian calendar anytime soon. But anyway, that's just a little tip for you.
I don't know if the cows can actually predict time unless it's digital. Do you think they know what the numbers mean? Yeah. Well, Steve, I appreciate you for doing the podcast, man. Can you tell people where they can find you at, such as all your links, you know, your Twitter, everything like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @Spartan_history, on Facebook at Spartan History Podcast. And my website is SpartanHistoryPodcast.com. www.SpartanHistoryPodcast.com.
I'll make sure I link it all in the description. And thank you for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank Podcast.